right away in the beginning of the Sedra, Shlach Lecho Anoshim. Rashi explains, Lecho Ledatcho. I'm leaving it up to you, Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't suggest that you send these spies, but if you want to send them, send them. If I heard that from the Rabbanu Shel Olam, I think I would have gotten the hint that it's not something to do. Yet Moshe sent them anyway. Why? And if we'll say that the people of Maisa at the time were tzaddikim, and Moshe didn't know there was going to be a problem, or he didn't think there was going to be a problem. And it says that, Kulam Anoshim, Melamed, Shebaoso Shah, Hayu Kulam Tzaddikim. They're all Anoshim. Anoshim means Tzaddikim. However, there's two problems with that. One is Rashi later on contradicts himself. Says Vayelchu Vayavo, they went and they came back. Says Rashi, Makish Halichoson Lebiyosim. It compares their going with their coming back. Just like when they came back they were Rishoyim, when they left they also Rishoyim. It means Lechora that they weren't Tzaddikim in the beginning. They were Rishoyim in the beginning. So which was it? In addition to that, Moshe must have known there's some kind of plot because he davened for Yoshua. Ka Yoshiach Meatzas Meraglim. God should save you from the plot of the miracle. So if Moshe knew there was a plot, and these people seemingly were not tzaddikim, according to at least one Rashi, then why did he send them? And we have the other Rashi that says they were tzaddikim, then why did he daven for Yoshua, call Yoshiach, and he asked us for miracle, if he thought they were all tzaddikim? In addition, there's another medrashim, a group of medrashim, that seem totally contradictory. One medrash says that only 10 of them took from the fruit. 8 took the cluster of grapes. They carried, 8 took 8 people to carry that cluster of grapes. One of them took a pomegranate, and one of them took a fig. And the other two, Kalev and Yoshua, didn't take anything. Shalohoyu boso eitz. They weren't part of the plot, therefore they didn't bring fruit. Meaning that the fruit was part of the plot. There's another medrash that says that when it came to taking the fruit, Kalev and Yoshua drew their swords. And they said to the other 10, either you take the fruit, or we're going to kill you, or you're going to kill us. But you're going to take that fruit. Mashma, that the fruit was something good to take. And Adarabba, Kalev and Yoshua forced the other ones to take the fruit. So what do you mean? They didn't take the fruit because they weren't part of the plot. Then the food was part of the plot. Why they forced the other ones to take it? So you could say it's medrashim that argue, but it's not good to make arguments. In addition, you have to say something because Moshe Rabbeinu told them to take the fruit. How can it be that the fruit was part of the plot if Moshe Rabbeinu said vischazakdem, right? You should strengthen yourselves. The ulakachtem ipriar, it's take from the fruit. So they had to take from the fruit. So what does the fruit have to do with the plot? In order to answer all of this, I want to give a general introduction to my perception of what the Chet HaMeraglim was, what it was based on, and for that we need a general introduction into Hashgachas Hashem, how the Ribono Shel Olam conducts his divine providence, his Hashgacha, his guidance of the world. There are basically three kinds of relationships that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has with Klal Yisrael. How his Hashgacha, how the divine providence comes to Klal Yisrael. In the desert, there was what was called Hashgacha Nisis, miraculous relationship. Nothing happened naturally, everything was supernatural. They had to eat, they had man. They had a drink, they had a be'er that traveled with them. People sinned, immediately fire came out of the heavens and burnt them up. Everything was immediate and supernatural, and you could see clearly God's hand every step along the way. That's Hashgacha, Gluya, Nisis, open, miraculous, divine providence. The second kind of Hashgacha is what happened in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. And that is Hashgacha Nisim Nistorim. Miracles, but hidden miracles. things appear to happen naturally. You don't get man falling out of the heavens. You have to plant and plow and fertilize and harvest and make flour and bread, and that's how you eat. But whether there's going to be rain or not, whether the crops are going to be successful, has a direct correlation between Torah and mitzvahs and material success. And you can see the correlation. The weatherman in those days didn't get on the air and say there is a cold system, a cold front approaching from the east, and the high pressure, low pressure system, and therefore we predict rain in 3 days. He got on the air and he said, we've taken a survey, and 95% of Yidden are keeping the Torah, and therefore it's going to rain in 3 days. Open correlation between Torah and mitzvahs. You could see it. You could see the people did mitzvahs, things were successful, things people didn't do mitzvahs, they weren't successful. That was called, the Ramban says in the beginning of Parshas Bechukosai, that's called Hashgacha Nisin Nistorim. It's miracles, but hidden miracles, because there's no physical correlation between Torah and mitzvahs and nature. So it's a miraculous thing, but it's hidden, because it looks like it's happening naturally. And then there's the Hashgacha that we're familiar with called Hester Ponim. God hides his face. And things appear to happen haphazardly, cause and effect, natural causes and effects, political, social, economic causes that cause the effects in this world, and very little is seen of God's hand in everything. That's called Hester Ponim. It doesn't, Chas V'Shalom, mean that God has abandoned the world and lets things up to chance and to all kinds of haphazard causes. Just he hides his face. Everything, the Vilna Gaon says, all these three levels are the same from God's side. From God's side, every single thing that happens in this world is Hashgachas Hashem. God is the one behind everything that happens. He's the cause. Nothing could happen if God doesn't want it to happen. However, how it appears to us is the three ways. Sometimes it appears to us direct, open. Sometimes it appears to us in a hidden, miraculous way. And sometimes we can't see the correlation. We can't see God's hand at all. He hides his face. Not that he abandons us. Not that he goes on vacation. Hester Ponim literally means he hides his face. You don't see it clearly. It's hidden. But it's there. It's just hidden. So says the Vilna Gaon. Now the people of that generation knew that the Hashgacha was going to change. That when they got to Eretz Yisrael, for various reasons, they knew that they no longer were going to be directed by God the same way they were in the desert. The man was going to stop, the be'er would stop, and things would happen more indirectly. Miraculously, but hidden miracles through nature. Things would happen through nature. And they assumed, and there was many reasons for that. One is because the people were not on the level, really, to be able to deal with that direct, open relationship with God. It was too demanding of them. And Moshe Rabbeinu, already after the sin of the golden calf, God wanted to send an angel, and meaning no longer to deal with them directly, but indirectly through natural means. And Moshe begged them, as long as he was alive, he would be able to keep them on the level that they'd be able to function like that. And God agreed with him, accepted that, and as soon as Moshe died, a malach came to Yoshua and said, Ato Bossi, and the Vilna Gaon says that was the angel of nature, that from then on the Hashgacha changed. There are other reasons too. God wanted them to have different kind of free choice. He wanted them to learn 40 years in the desert, or whatever time they were in the desert, that he controls the world. But he wanted them to have free choice where they could make the choice to believe in God's control where it wasn't so obvious. In any case, whatever the reason was, they knew that when they come into Eretz Yisrael, things would begin to happen naturally, not supernatural. They made one mistake. They assumed that if it's happening naturally, they're in control. That God has relinquished his control and put it into their hands. That's what naturally means. We're in control. That was a mistake. And therefore, they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, We are soon going to enter Eretz Yisrael. It was within a matter of days. And we are going to start to function on a natural mode. We want to prepare for that. How do you function on a natural mode? You send spies. Spy out the land. We want this. We know it's going to have to be done naturally. We want to start now. So Moshe Rabbeinu said to the Rabbanu Shlom, what do I do? So God said, that's fine. Right? They want to begin to start functioning according to the new mode that's going to be natural. That's fine. But then you can't come to me and ask me what to do, because that's not the way it works when things are happening natural. When things happen in a natural way, the leader doesn't go to God and ask him what to do, and he gets an answer. What does he do? He opens up a Gemara. You go to the leader, and with his Das Torah, with his understanding of Torah, he tells you what he thinks God wants from you. And that's what you're supposed to do. Apiyat Torah, Sheyorucha. He doesn't ask God and get a direct message from God. That happens in the desert. That doesn't happen when things are happening naturally. So God said, I can't command you. Manavshach. If they want to start this natural process, then it can't be supernatural. So you decide, because that's the way it is when things are natural. So God didn't tell him not to do it. He just told him that you can't do it this way if you want it to be this way. It's either one. You can't have both things. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that these people understood natural divine providence, or divine providence through natural means, in a wrong way. They understood that it meant that they're in control. And Moshe could have told them the shir I'm giving you. And I'm sure I convinced you. You understand. You believe it. They would have believed it. But there's a very big difference between believing something and really, really feeling it where you live according to it. Okay? The prime example that the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva gives of believing and really feeling, there's a level where belief comes to be real to you, and then you live according to it. Every respect, even when it means sacrifice. Even if you believe something. And they give the example, right? You walk into a park and you see one of these green park benches in America glistening, and there's a sign on it, wet paint. What is the natural reflex reaction of most people? They come next to the bench. Why? And they look at their finger and there's the green paint. Don't you believe signs? It says wet paint. It looks wet. Why do you have to touch it? Because there's a gap between what you know intellectually and what you actually feel. My father, Olav HaShalom, used to say this joke to show the difference between these difference of a person who believes and a person who really believes. And that doesn't mean that the person that doesn't believe believes. But it's different between believing and really, really feeling it. An atheist falls off a cliff. He's plummeting to his death. And he figures it's worth a try. So he looks up to heaven. He says, look, I know that I've led my life as if there's no God. But just in case there is, God, I promise you, if you save me, I will be your faithful servant for the rest of my life. And at that moment, a tree pushes its way through the side of the mountain, and the person falls and gets caught in the tree, in the branches of the tree. You realize an open miracle. The tree wasn't there before. It pushed its way out just to save him. He looks up. He says, thank you, God. I'm your faithful servant. He's hanging by the limb for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, getting tired. He looks up to heaven. He said, God, what would you like me to do now? And a voice thunders out of the heavens, let go of the branch. The guy thinks for a few seconds, he looks back up and he says, is anybody else up there? Yeah, sometimes, you know, you believe, but to let go of the branch, that's a little much. So, if you don't really feel it, right, it's not real to you, right? Another example they give is, there was a man in Kovna, who was the richest person in Kovna. He owned a fleet of merchant marine, which he rented out to transport goods by sea. And he was a wealthy man. His boats were not insured, and they all were rented out, and they all sank in a storm. And a telegram came to the Jewish authority in Kovna, to tell them that this man's, all his boats sank, and they weren't insured. He was now a pauper. So they said, somebody has to go tell this. He's an elderly man. The shock may kill him. So somebody's got to go and try to get the message across without killing this person. So they called the Rav of the city, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the Rav of Kovna, and they told him, this is your job. Here's the telegram. Go let the guy know that he's not only not rich anymore, he is a debtor. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan went to this guy's house. The guy says, what do I owe this honor of the rabbi coming to me? He said, I'll tell you, we're having a kenes and a gathering to strengthen people's emunah and bitachon, their faith and trust and belief in God. And I decided if I get up and speak and say that you shouldn't trust money and you should trust only in God and don't trust people or whatever, people would say, is the rabbi supposed to say that? But if you, the richest man in Kovna, would get up and say that you can't put your trust in money and you can't put your trust in people, but everything that the Rabbeinu Shlom does is for the good or whatever, people would listen, right? Coming from you would make a difference. So I want you to be the guest speaker at this gathering. He said, but I want you to believe what you're saying. So I want to sit with you and learn with you a little bit of the laws of the ideas of bitachon, of faith and trust in God. And hopefully you'll be ready to make this speech. So they sit down, learn about a half an hour. And the rabbi looks up and he says to him, okay, how do you feel? Oh, I really feel strong. I really have faith in God. Yeah, everything is for the good. Yeah, 100%. What if I would tell you that one of your boats sank? He said, one of my boats? You should know that my boats aren't insured. And it would be a very big loss. But I think I'd be able to say, Gamzu Latova, God runs the world. Don't trust in boats. And my boat sank and it's a great loss, but God knows what he's doing. And really, it's for the good. I would say, Gamzu Latova. That's very nice. So what if I would tell you all your boats sank? All my boats. I'd be in debt. I would be a pauper. I don't know if I could handle that. So what do you think you need to handle that? He said, maybe another half an hour learning. So they learn another half an hour. At the end of the half hour, he says to him, no. And what if I would tell you now that all your boats sank? He said, now I think I would say Gamzu Latova, right? You can't put your trust in money. Just because I was rich doesn't mean that I was secure. And if the Rabbeinu Shlom took everything away from me and made me a pauper, there's probably a good reason for it. And it's good for my Olam Haba. And I would say Gamzu Latova, it's all for the good. It's great. He takes out the telegram, gives it to him. The guy reads the telegram, faints dead away. They call Hatzolah, take him to the hospital. He's hovering between life and death for 3 days. Finally, he pulls through. The rabbi goes to visit him. He says, I understand. 2 seconds before I gave you the telegram, I asked you how you would react if I told you that all your boats sank. You told me it'd say Gamzu Latova, and you believe it's all for the good, and God runs the world, he knows what he's doing. I gave you the telegram, we almost lost you. What happened? He said, yeah, I told you that when I thought my boats were sailing, but my boats really sank. There's a very big difference between when you have emunah, when the boats are sailing, or your emunah is when the boats really sank. So Moshe Rabbeinu could have explained to the people their mistake. Nature does not mean that you're in control. It means that God is still in control, but he makes it look natural. And the people would have nodded their heads and said, yeah, 100%. But then when it came time to fighting the enemy, they wouldn't have believed deep down in their heart that it was God who was going to bring the success. They would have put the trust in the weapons or whatever. And if they didn't have better weapons or the enemy outnumbered, then they'd be scared. Because if you really believe in this, as long as you make your hishtadlis, you make your effort, it's not a cause-effect relationship, says the Michta Meliyov. It's a condition, a prerequisite. You put in your hishtadlis and God gives you, you don't earn a living, you don't make a living. God gives you a living, the same way he gave the man. Except when it happens naturally, God wants you to go through the motions, and if you go through the motions properly, then, based on other considerations, God will give you a parnasan. But it's never cause and effect. I cause my parnasan. If you think about it, it's clear like that. The guy digs ditches, gets paid $50 an hour for digging ditches, works 8 hours a day, makes what's it called, $400 a day. Right? At the end of the week, he has $2,400 that he's supposed to get. What in the world is there a correlation between digging ditches and getting that $2,400? Right? Digging ditches does not create $400 an hour. LMI, your employer is going to pay you. Who said he's going to make it? Maybe he's going to drop dead. Maybe his children don't want to pay you. Maybe the economy will, the banks will fail, theoretically speaking, you know, that things like that don't happen. But and there won't be any money. Maybe the guy will drop dead in the middle of the week, or he'll become paralyzed, won't be able to dig digits anymore. There's so many factors that you don't control that to believe that it's cause and effect, that's how you make a living, is absurd. Let's look around. And even though God runs the world in a way that makes it look natural, but the exceptions make it clear that even the regular is not necessarily cause and effect. There are plenty of people who in Russia, other examples, but this is one, had all the right hishtadlus. They did everything right to earn a very nice living. They had degrees in engineering, they were doctors, they were whatever. And then they were forced to leave Russia, come to America, come to Israel, come to other countries. There's a glut in engineers, and they can't find a job. Because they're engineers, because they did everything right to make a good parnasa, they have no parnasa. So they're cleaning the offices of other engineers. But the cause and effect, they should be making a nice living. And they're scrounging through garbage cans to eat. And the opposite's also true. People do sometimes the craziest things, which anybody in their right mind would say, this is not going to cause you a parnasa, and they become rich. Example, about 25, 30 years ago in America, they had what was called pet rocks. Pet rocks was the following. A guy decided he's going to package rock, plain ordinary rock, go outside, get a rock, put it in a box. The box was printed up, looked like a cage. Plain cardboard, little cardboard box, like for animal crackers. They have a cage, that's what it was, cage. And the rock came in this cage, and it was a pet rock. And it had one sheet of instructions how to care for this pet. You didn't have to feed it, you didn't have to walk it, you didn't have to give it water, didn't need air. Very cheap and easy pet to take care of. And you bought the pet, what did you get? A rock, the box, and a sheet of instructions for $10, $9.99. Now, if somebody would have come to you and said, look, you want to invest in this great idea, you would have said, there's nobody in the world that's going to buy a rock for $10 when you can go outside and get a whole zoo of them for free. But give it to Americans, and there were millions of people who bought rocks for $10. And it was a fad. The guy became a millionaire overnight. That's cause and effect. Another example. Guy decided, great idea. He's going to make dolls that are uglier than a mother could love. Cabbage patch dolls. I know some kids who look like those dolls. But they were made specifically to be ugly. Now, what mother, what little girl is going to want an ugly doll? It doesn't make any sense. But again, leave it to Americans. It became a fad. And overnight, the guy became... and there were whole extended families of ugly dolls. One uglier than the other, and people bought them up like they were hotcakes. So, parnasa is not something that you can attribute to cause and effect. You put in your hashtadlis, and in the end, if the Rebbe Shem wants you to be rich, he'll make you rich, and if not, you can do everything right and be nothing, and you can do everything wrong and be rich. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu had to somehow get this message across, not just by giving the shiur, but that they should ein chacham kebala nisoya. They should go live through it and learn it through experience. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu knew there was an atzas meraglim. Atzas meraglim does not mean a plot of people who are going to come back and malign Eretz Yisrael. In fact, in another medrash, it calls atzas meraglim atzas hador hazeh, the eitzah, the idea of this generation, meaning this mistake. There was an idea that brought to sending spies that if it's going to happen naturally, we're in charge. That was the mistake. That was called atzas meraglim. The idea behind meraglim. The idea of this generation. And it was a mistake. And again, Moshe could have convinced them intellectually, but that wouldn't have made the difference when it really came down to living it. So he said, you know what, I'm going to send them. And I hope that they'll come to the following conclusion by what they experience. They have information given. God said it's going to happen naturally. God said it's going to happen. you're going to conquer this land and settle it. We are going now and experiencing that it can't be done through our hands. It's impossible. There's no way we can do it. What should be the conclusion? That therefore, if it happens naturally, we don't have to do it. God will do it and make it look natural. All we have to do is go through the motions. That should have been their conclusion. If they accepted that God said it's going to happen naturally, God said it's going to happen, we see we can't do it. So if I believe in the first two things, and the third thing is true, then it must be that we made a mistake, and happening naturally is not that we're doing it. God is still doing it. He's going to make it look natural, and we only have to go through the motions. That's what they should have concluded. And then it would have been real to them. Instead, they made another conclusion, unfortunately. Even Yeshua made that conclusion. The rest of the spies made the following conclusion. God said that it's going to happen naturally. We see it can't happen naturally. Therefore, it can't happen. That was their conclusion. And that's why they said, Ki chazak hu mimenu, the enemy is stronger than God. What were they, kindergarten children? Some guy with a big axe is stronger than God? What do they think? What do they think of God? They said they're stronger than God. God can't get them out of there. Why not? Because they believe that God himself tied his hands. God said it's going to happen naturally. And that's God's will. He's not going to do it differently than he said. And if he said it's going to happen naturally, we have to do it. And we can't do it, so God can't help us. Because if he helps us, it's not happening naturally anymore. So based on their mistake, it was true. God can't do it. They're stronger than God because that's God's will. He tied his hands. That's what it means. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping that they would come to the right conclusion. However, there was one thing that could really push them over the brink one way or the other. And Moshe said, if you don't need to have to confront this thing, don't do it. Because to put yourself in a situation that is do or die, that could push you over the brink or could convince you, it's not worth taking that risk. So if you need the chizuk, if you're still not convinced, I want you to confront this idea. If you don't need the chizuk, stay away from it. It's like people who have questions in emunah should investigate them or whatever. But people don't have any questions, don't investigate, you're going to end up creating questions. What was that thing? The fruit. Because if you think that in natural circumstances you're in control, then it should bring you to total yiush, total despair, the fact that your food supply you can't control. Because it depends on a factor that you can't control called rain. You can't have a food supply if it doesn't rain. And you can't make it rain. Till today, there's no way for man to make it rain. The most he can do, maybe you see clouds, which also isn't always effective. But if there's no clouds, you can't create clouds. Rain is something that's in the hand of God. So if you really believe that when God leaves things to a natural order, then we are still in control, then we're in control, then you're faced with your food supply. Either you're going to say, I made a mistake, we're not in control, it's going to happen naturally, and naturally means God's still in control, and we just have to fulfill a condition. Or you can totally give up hope and say, God said it's going to happen naturally, and we can't make it rain, and therefore we are pawns, and we're not in control of our fate, and we are subject to total happenstance and coincidence, and there's nothing we can do about it, and you give up hope. So Moshe Rabbeinu told them the following, V'hischazaktem. If you need the chizuk, if you're still not convinced and you need to be convinced, then I want you to confront the fruit. Because that's either going to make it or break it. He's going to push you over the brink totally, or it's going to make you convinced that nature means that God's still in control. But if you don't need the chizuk, then better not to confront the fruit. Leave it alone. Because why push yourself to an nisayon that maybe you can't handle? If you already believe, so leave it with that. Don't confront the fruit. Therefore, the Midrashim are perfect. Kalei ben Yoshua, who were not part of the plot, meaning they were convinced. The Moshe Rabbeinu told them, don't take the fruit, only if you need the chizuk. Hischazaktem. But the other ones still weren't convinced. And Moshe Rabbeinu told them, if you're not convinced, I want you to take the fruit. So Kalev and Yeshua forced the other ones to take the fruit. Because that's what Moshe said. You're going to confront that. Maybe it'll help. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll push you over the brink. But you can't lose anything. Right? There's nothing to lose. As in, if you continue the way you are, you've already lost the game. So it's worth the risk. But if you're already okay to take the risk and maybe lose everything, it's not condemned. So, and that is what the aftermath of the Chet HaMeraglim was. They came back, they convinced the people of this idea. It's going to have to happen naturally. We were witnesses that it can't happen naturally. And therefore it can't happen. We're going to be decimated. And the people cried that night. Crying was a symbol of total despair, giving up hope, abandonment. We're abandoned. There's nothing anymore to think about. God has abandoned us. He's abandoned us to nature. He told us that we can do it, and we can't do it. Finished. And that was the end of the whole thing. That was the crying. What corrects that? The crying we do on Tisha B'Av. God said, Atem b'chisem b'chir shalchinim. You cried for nothing, because you weren't abandoned. I'm still in charge. I'm still going to help you. I promised you you'll conquer them. Ah, you can't do it? You don't have to do it. You just have to go through the motions. You just have to do your istatlus. So therefore, God put us into Golus, and we'd like to come back to Eretz Yisrael, build the Beis HaMikdash, let Mashiach come, but we know we can't do it. So on Tisha B'Av we cry, but it's a different kind of crying. That's called Bechiah Shel Mamash. That's a crying of substance. It's like a baby crying. Why does a baby cry? A baby knows that something's uncomfortable. He knows that he can't do anything about it. He doesn't even know what exactly is wrong. He just knows he's uncomfortable. But he knows if he cries, he's going to awaken an adult form, usually in the form of a female, that's going to come, know exactly what the problem is, and correct it. That's the way we cry in Tisha B'Av. Ribbono Shel Olam, you promised us that you're going to redeem us. We can't do it. And every time we begin to think we can do it, the Ribbono Shel Olam shows us that we can't do it. And no matter what we think, we have a state, and we, you know, never again, and we can now control that no anti-Semite can raise him, so we have an army. So what is the army worth in the kinds of terror that we have? We can't even use the army, because the nations of the world are against us and will decimate us if we use our army, because then we're conquerors and cruel and who knows what, all these terrorists. So our hands are tied. Because we're so strong, that's why we can't fight this war. Because if we'd be weaklings, then they'd have Rachmanis on us. But because we're the stronger ones, we're the conquerors, we're the occupiers, so our army is useless. So every time we think that we can rely on something else and we're the ones in control, the Ribbono Shel Olam shows us that's not the case. So we cry on Tisha B'Av. Ribbono Shel Olam, you said you're going to redeem us. You said we're going to get out of all this galus. And we can't do it. So we cry because we know that you'll do it for us. All we have to do is keep up our part of the bargain. All we have to do is go through the motions that you told us to do, and if we do the right things, and we fulfill our part of the bargain, and we do what is the conditions that we have to fulfill the prerequisites, then you'll do it. That's the opposite kind of crying that they cried by the Meraglim. A corollary to this is that even when the Torah seems, God said, I want you to conquer Eretz Israel, I want you to settle Eretz Israel, and it seemed impossible. It seemed very nice abstractly, but not real. That you should realize that even Kiyum HaTorah is possible, but it may not be something that you can do on your own. You need God's help. It says that every day a person's Yetzer Hara gets stronger, and if God wouldn't help him, he wouldn't be able to overcome it. And even though Hakol Bidei Shamayim Chutz Meyiras Shamayim, God doesn't control our free choice, but that's the choice. You make the choice. You fulfill the condition. And then I'll help you. Mitzvah Goreres Mitzvah. Siyata Dishmaya. It's difficult. You open a Gemara, I'll never be able to figure this out. The language is difficult. The ideas are foreign to me. I'll never be a Talmud Chacham. I'm breaking my teeth on the words. Yeah, in a Chanami, it could be that naturally speaking, you'll never be able to learn that. But all the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to do is go through the motions. You make the attempt. You put in the work. And then the Ribbono Shel Olam, Yogati, you put in the effort, Matsasi, God will give you a Metziah. He'll give you a find. He'll give you as a present. A lot of things in Torah are very difficult. That was another mistake of the Meraglim. They said Eretz Yisrael is impossible in reality to conquer. It's a nice place to come and visit and take pictures and slides and bring back home, but it's not a place to live. It's not livable. It's not real. It's a fantasy world. Torah is very nice, but it's not real. It's not something to look up to. But to live like that, not to speak Lashon Hara, is impossible. To be moral, impossible. It's not real. It's like Disney World. Disney World's a great place to visit. Nobody lives there. It's not a real place to live. And the Marashah says it. What do they bring back? Which fruit do they bring back? Grapes, figs, pomegranates. What didn't they bring back? The other four things. Barley and wheat, oil, and dates. What's the difference between them? Figs, pomegranates, and grapes are great desserts. They're not staples of life. Barley, wheat, oil you need for cooking and for light, and dates, the Gemara says, is a staple. You can exist. There's even a svara that you make a bench on dates. It's amazing. It's a staple of life, dates. That's what the Marashah says. They came back and they said, Eretz Yisrael is great for dessert. It's a great place to visit as a fantasy world, but you can't live there. I wanted to say that's what they said. Eretz Ocheles Yoshiveha. It's a place that eats up its inhabitants. It doesn't eat up the tourists. Tourists, everything's fine. It eats up the inhabitants. You can't really live there. You can visit there. There's a famous joke, I think they attribute it to Ben-Gurion, that somebody was complaining of how difficult it is to live in Israel. So Ben-Gurion, and he said that, you know, when he was anticipating and planning or whatever, it didn't seem this way. So Ben-Gurion said, I'll tell you a story. So there's a person who died clinically, and his neshama went up to heaven, and they said, really, it's not your time to be here, you're going back, but while you're here already, we'll show you around. Then they took him to Gan Eden, they showed him people sitting and learning Torah, and he said, I don't really think that I could, you know, do this long term. I don't really think. They took him to Gehenna, and he see people eating and drinking and partying. He said, you know what, I think this is more my style. So they put him back to earth. 30 years later, he dies, comes back, comes to the gates of heaven, and the angel says, you were here before. He said, yeah. He said, well, we're going to give you a choice where you'd like to go. You can choose. You want to go to Gan Eden, you want to go to Gehenna. He said, well, I'll tell you, I was here, and Gan Eden didn't really seem to be my speed. Gehenna was more what I could relate to. So I think I want to go to Gehenna. No, it's fine. The angel says, your choice. Takes him to Gehenna. And immediately they tie him up on the wall, hang him from the wall, start to boil him in oil, right? Beat him, torture him. And there's all the people hanging from the wall being tortured. They say, hey, wait a second. He said, I was here before. And this is not what was going on. People were eating, drinking, and partying. He said, yeah, before you were a tourist. There's a very difference between being a tourist and actually living here. That's what Ben-Gurion told him. Right? Tourist is one thing. Now you live here, it's a different story. So that's what the Meraglim said. Eretz Yisrael is not a place where you can really live. It's a nice place to visit, take slides of, talk about in school, right? Celebrate Yom HaTzma'ut, eat fruit on Tu B'Shvat, but live there? That's impossible. And people say that about other things in the Torah too. Lashon Hara, oh, great idea to speak about it, but not to speak it? It's impossible. Human beings can't not speak Lashon Hara. And so too with all many of the other mitzvahs. In fact, the wife of Rabbi Cheskel of Ramsky brought a proof that that's not the case. If the Torah says something's possible, it's possible for real, in real life. Because the Torah permitted the captive woman to make a speed conversion for her because the Torah knew that under those circumstances, a person could not control his yetzer hara, and he's going to end up living with her as a goya. Better you should convert her speed wise than you should live with her as a goya. So that means where the Torah knows that it's impossible for a person to humanly make the right choice, the Torah permits it. That means where the Torah doesn't permit something, or it makes us do something that it's humanly possible to do. Because if it wouldn't be, the Torah wouldn't prohibit it. So, but that's a corollary of this. If you think that you're always in control, then if a mitzvah is difficult to do naturally, then you can't do it. But if you realize that you're not the one who does and brings things to fruition, even when it comes to mitzvahs, all you have to do is make that prerequisite, go through the conditions, make the start, and then the Rabban Shem will help you. Then everything is possible. Because ultimately it's God who's the one who's helping you. You can't do it on your own. You never can do it on your own. You make your heart beat. Every 2 seconds you're thinking, beat, 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 right? Keeping it going. You're not keeping it going. Obviously God's keeping it going. So if God keep your heart going, he does everything else too. Except we have a responsibility to go through the motions and fulfill the conditions and the prerequisites. And that's our part. But ultimately, bring things to fruition. The Rabban Shem brings them to fruition. So, Mirtz Hashem, we understand that. And again, we can understand it intellectually from one shear. But even the great people, the Meraglim, and they went through and experienced it, and they made the mistake, except for Kalev and Yoshua. But now that the Torah gave us this parsha, we can use it to strengthen ourselves and to really understand this concept intellectually, abstractly, and lamaisa, and really live it, and understand that even if things happen in a natural way, we are not the cause, and therefore, what's important for us to do is to fulfill our conditions in the most ideal way, spiritually and physically, and in that way, have bitachon that the Rabban Shem will see that everything we do, whether it's spiritual or physical, will come to a good fruition.